entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. A solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Afghans are yet to wait for the rise of peace in their war-ravaged country, as the ongoing war in Afghanistan continues to claim the lives of large numbers of civilians, including women and children, on a daily basis. According to rights bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 30,000 civilians were killed and more than 60,000 others, including women and children, injured in the Afghan war over the past 11 years. All conflicting sides, including terrorist groups, US-led NATO troops and pro-government forces, are being blamed for these casualties. However, some international bodies like the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, and other independent bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, name chiefly terrorist groups accountable for much of these casualties. They also call on the Afghan government to bring the killers of Afghan people into justice via any possible legal attempt.
Unfortunately, nearly 100,000 civilians, including women and children, have fallen victim to the war in Afghanistan over the past 11 years. We call on the government to share its findings about these deaths and bring the accountable figures to justice.
This comes as experts believe there would be no zero civilian casualties unless the Taliban militant group changes its mind and accepts a new Afghanistan that differs from what it was before 2001.
Approval of a ceasefire by Taliban is highly important. They must realize that remaining indifferent to the sufferings of people will have dire consequences.
Violence has been rising in Afghanistan amid intra-Afghan talks in Doha and US troops withdrawal. Afghanistan remains in the 11 most dangerous nations list for children, according to Save the Children. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross reported last month that Afghanistan remains the deadliest country for civilians. Half of the civilian fatalities include Afghan women and children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
Deutschland hat sich in den vergangenen Monaten.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
Regarding the U.S., our policy has been a calculated and transparent policy, one that will not change with the arrival of different individuals. Today is the U.S. presidential elections. Some people keep talking about who should and should not come. They speak about the consequences of each candidate winning. Well, certain things might happen, but they will not be of any concern to us as they will not influence our policy in any way, because our policy is a calculated and transparent policy, one that will not be affected with the arrival of individuals. However, if you look at their own condition, you will find them in a spectacular condition. The president who currently holds office and who is organizing the election says that this is one of the most fraudulent elections in U.S. history. Who says this? This is being claimed by a person who is president himself and who is actually holding and administering the elections.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The other candidate says in return that Trump intends to rig the elections on a large scale. This is American democracy. They themselves are saying these things about their elections. This is an example of the ugly reality of liberal democracy inside the U.S. Well, no matter which one will be elected, it will become clear which one will be the winner. There is a completely clear point, which is the political, civil and moral decline of the American regime. This will not change with the arrival of either of them. The American regime is truly and severely suffering from a political, civil and moral decline, and this is not mere analysis. What I am saying here is not merely an analysis, rather, this is being acknowledged by themselves.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, more than a month since the U.S. presidential election, and clashes are still taking place between Trump supporters and those against him. Trump and much of the Republican Party, as well as many of his supporters, continue to say that the election was fraudulent. With emotions running high, clashes have taken place in several cities in the U.S., with several people being taken to the hospital. Where is this going? And with this country so greatly divided, could either a Biden presidency or a Trump presidency be able to bring this country together again? Well, I'm going to start this off with crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to correspondent Wyatt Reed. Wyatt, thanks so much for being with us. Wyatt, you actually been covering the situation and also the demonstrations that took place yesterday. Tell us about the overall emotional aspect of it, because temperatures seem to be running as high as prior to the election.
Yes, it was quite an eventful day. Tempers really flaring yesterday. We saw thousands of pro-Trump demonstrators who took again to the streets. This was sort of a follow-up to last month's Stop the Steal rally. We saw much of the same dynamics playing out. What was notable was that the Proud Boys seemed to have a stronger presence. The Proud Boys, of course, frequently described as a neo-fascist group. They were infamously told by President Donald Trump to stand back and stand by in a September presidential debate. They spent much of the day inciting violence against anyone who they sort of perceived to be their ideological opponents, that would be anti-fascists or Black Lives Matter protesters, before spending the evening essentially on the hunt for any kind of Black Lives Matter banisters. There are a number of them displayed prominently throughout the Washington, D.C. Area, and they were stealing these signs, vandalizing them, returning them. One in particular was a Black Lives Matter sign that they stole from the Ashbury United Methodist Church, which is the city's oldest Black Methodist church, and then they promptly burned that, leading many local activists and observers to point out sort of the historic connections between this kind of group and between the racial intimidation that has long characterized the far right in this country.
To jump in here, but what about police presence and the reaction of police on the scene there?
Police presence was somehow, to many observers, both overdoing it and somehow underdoing it, a little bit too much and not enough at the same time. Cops had a strong presence throughout much of the day. They were blocking off Black Lives Matter Plaza from anyone entering for much of the day. Hundreds and hundreds of police deployed for sure, but it seemed that when it counted, that is to say when the far-right formations were attempting to sort of go out and instigate any kind of violence, the police were nowhere to be found. We've seen dozens of videos on social media of the numerous fights instigated by, generally speaking, by the right-wing forces, and the police were not anywhere to be found in many of these videos. Of course, they did arrest somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 people, and they're not saying specifically whether those people were pro-Trump, anti-Trump, Antifa, Proud Boys. None of that information has been forthcoming so far, but the police presence to many on the ground left quite a bit to be desired.
All right, thanks so much for being with us, Wyatt Reed, correspondent in D.C. I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and radio host Don DeBar. Don, great to see you.
Hi, Marcy. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked, Don.
Yeah,
but, Don, when we look at the situation and what's going on, I mean, these demonstrations are taking place 5 weeks after many Americans believe that Biden was announced the winner of the election and president-elect. Your perspective, why are we still seeing such violent clashes to take place?
I'm not in D.C. today or this weekend. I'm speaking with people there regularly over the last couple of days, and I've been watching the marches that have been taking place on in various internet news carriers. I can't use the most appropriate term for this, but the television-friendly version would be, it's like a doo-doo burlesque that we're seeing. There's, we always know this, the apparent and material, or, what you see and what is. And here we have a context of these two sides that have, these are the ones that are advocating for one of the other candidates in the election, blue, red hat, of that dichotomy. They've been agitated to the point now for 4 years and change into believing that the other is an existential threat to them. That one hand, Trump represents Hitler, fascism, all of that, and they're looking to take away your liberties, freedom, and put you in gulag or something. On the other side, they're communists, they're with the Chinese, they're crazy left-wing radical maniacs, and they're looking to take away your property, doing the gulag. That's the mindset of a lot of people that are on the street right now on either side of this. Now, the marches you see this weekend, the official marches were Trump support, Trump campaign oriented, retail politics kind of demonstrations. They were not Proud Boy led or anything else. The Proud Boys, for example, are an insignificant portion of the people that were marching this weekend in Washington. Antifa, for all of the press that this gets, also is really not representative of the opposite side of Biden supporters. And so we're watching a wrestling match on a television that's supposed to represent our struggle. Mm-hmm. Because you also have behind Biden and Trump a real power struggle among the elite in the United States over a number of really important issues, including most important, war and peace.
Okay, Don, stay with me. I'm definitely going to pick up and continue with you and that line that you just brought up. But let me introduce and get in our next guest to the program, Jack Rice, lawyer and media analyst out of Minneapolis. Jack, thanks so much for being with us. Sam, what do you think? Do you think that Biden has actually been officially claimed the winner? Or does this really have to wait until the Electoral College members meet? Is this over yet, or is there still a possibility that the results will be turned around?
Well, I guess it just depends upon whom you ask, right? Yeah. If we look at where we are right now, there have been more than 36 lawsuits that have been filed by the Trump administration, or by the Trump team in this case, including the latest by the U.S. Supreme Court. That was before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was simply turned back by saying, you have no justification to even be in this courtroom right now because you're not one of the parties. But if you can think about one of these that just happened yesterday in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and also another, a federal court in Wisconsin, where they said the Trump team wants us to apply the rule of law. We have. Understand, that was a Republican who was on the bench. This was a Trump person who was put on the bench by Trump. And in fact, that is something that is absolutely scorching. This has happened again and again and again. We have never seen anything quite like this in the United States. And so I think about this as a trial lawyer, watching what it is that the courts are doing at the district court levels in places like Georgia, in places like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, Arizona. The list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he's getting beaten in this way. And the question now will be, does he stop? He says he won't. But the problem is that from a legal standpoint, he has very few places to go.
Well, Jack, staying with you, I mean, and we talk about the various lawsuits that have been thrown out. What's your take on it all? Is it because with the claims of fraud, of course, that he has said, is it that he's losing these cases? Are basically the lawsuits are being thrown out because there has been no proof of fraud, or is it because of a cover-up, as Trump and his supporters claim?
You know, if you take a look at the people who are hearing these claims, many of whom are conservatives, Republicans, if you will, who are on the bench, who are judges in these cases, and they have looked at not only factual questions, because that has been a big part of this, but also legal decisions, looking at standing, looking at issues like that. These are not exceptions. These aren't little things. In fact, what we have heard in Pennsylvania was, in fact, there were no claims of fraud. What you've seen from the likes of Giuliani and some of his team is that they would go out into the press, and what they would do is they would spin extraordinary claims. And then when they would get in front of a judge, they would get ripped to pieces, and you would find that they couldn't even make the claims themselves. Now, understand, not just am I a former prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer, I teach trial advocacy worldwide, across the United States, and I watched what Giuliani was doing, what Giuliani was saying inside of courtrooms. When you read the transcripts, it was horrific how pitiful the arguments were worded. And I'm just saying this from a legal standpoint. They were absolutely beaten at every single stage, and they had nothing that they could use that would stick. And that's just a fact.
Okay. Well, Don, I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about what we're seeing in reality is this clash of the elite. I want you to expand on that, please. What do you mean?
Yeah, very briefly touch on what we just heard. It's not true. In the S, first of all, as a trial lawyer, the other guy's not stands that you don't score this like a bowling match. It's not 38 cases to 2 or whatever that decides prevails. In one case, you win if it's the right case. So, and the, most of the cases that have been decided so far were decided not on the merit of the arguments or of the claims, but rather over what he called legal issues, but technical issues, like the wrong party brought the lawsuit, which happened at the Supreme Court. There are viable cases pending, any one of which, any couple of which, could produce an outcome that could reverse the election. In addition to that, there are political processes involved going on, starting with the Electoral College tomorrow and going to the joint session on January 6th, where a different outcome could also come out. Speculating as to how likely that is, you know, that's a fool's errand, really. We don't know. This is uncharted territory. As far as it goes, but the behind-the-scenes game, and that's the part that makes it uncharted territory, you have had evidence in the United States before the world for the last 4 years, essentially the elite on one side, the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, most of the institutional power, the corporate and foundation media in the United States, a good part of the Republican Party, political establishment, Mitt Romney and, you know, going down the list, McCain, et cetera, all hostile to the President of the United States, and the claim, the public narrative that this was over, is the relationship between Trump and Russia, and the claim that United States not standing up to Russia because he's a puppet of the Russian government. Now, what that says is if the side that wants him out over that really means it and they prevail, then we could be looking potentially at a war with Russia. And if you look at the condition of relations when Trump took office, the United States was having war games at a regular basis on Russia's borders from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula. To me, that's the real game that's afoot here, and the rest of it is a TV show that we're looking at.
All right. Well, Jack, you talked, Don had talked about the Supreme Court and refusing to hear the complaint of fraudulent elections by Trump. In the state of Texas, now the head of the Republican Party in Texas, Alan West, has said that the state should consider seceding and forming another union with other states. Your take on his comments and the effect of these comments at this point in time?
Yeah, I would say he's simply pandering. I mean, he's pandering to the extreme part of his party. And honestly, I think it's treasonous. I truly do. I think that anybody who is an elected official in this case is actually talking about breaking up the United States of America is treasonous. A big part of what we see here is that it's not just about one person in one place. We have 126 members of the House of Representatives. That is a majority of the Republicans in the House of Representatives right now who are actually coming together. And yet, this was based upon this argument that was made in Texas. Now remember, I mean, this is a big part of what people sometimes forget, is that this is not so much a national election as it is basically 50 state elections. And the problem that they had in this case was that Texas was arguing that these other states didn't do their elections right. Well, the whole concept of federalism, the idea in the United States that is that each state themselves has the right, the literal right, to protect and to apply the laws as they see fit to their states themselves. The idea that Texas would say, we don't like what Georgia did, is almost anti-federalism. And understand, the strongest advocates for federalism in the United States were the conservatives themselves. So I've kind of been scratching my head watching this, and then you have more than half of the conservatives supporting it. Again, I'm completely amazed by this. Clearly, the answer is they don't like the outcome. They don't like how it played out, so therefore, they're going to fight every single fight.
Don, go ahead. You want to say something, Don? Go ahead.
Yeah, not only does each state have control of their process in selecting a president, but pursuant to the Constitution, of course, which is the state legislature, under Article 1, Section 2, was it 2-1? Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, the state legislature has to do it. They also have an expectation and a right, as basically as mutual consideration for entering into this agreement, that they expect this from each of the other states as well. And so they shouldn't be powerless to watch illegal processes go on in the other states where the state legislature should have been conducting, or the laws of that state were clearly violated, blatantly violated, that they have to live with the outcome, which alters their rights. In other words, if I'm playing by the rules and you're not, what game are we playing? And that's what the question that's going on. And that lawsuit, by the way, it was decided on the question of standing, that the states couldn't bring the action, but rather the aggrieved parties being Trump or the electors of those states would be the ones who would have, a stake in the argument I just presented.
But that's the problem.
Go ahead, Jack.
That's the problem, because what you ultimately have in a case like this is that the Supreme Court came down and said the state can't do this, and you still have half the Republicans on the Federalist side actually arguing that they should. Remember, out of nine Supreme Court justices, we had a majority who are conservatives. All three of Trump's appointees all came in together and said, you can't do this. The fact that you saw 17 attorneys general who were Republicans, 126 Republicans in the House of Representatives, all coming together, when in fact, the Supremes essentially completely, all nine, really seven, but not seven plus two, all came together and said, you can't. It's just astounding, because these very same people would never have argued this point before Trump lost, because that's not philosophically what we have seen. Not when somebody says, If I'm from Texas, nobody gets to tell me how Texas runs, certainly not Georgia, certainly not Pennsylvania. So it is astounding. I think we can agree on that.
You're a law professor. I don't want to argue the law with you unless we're in your classroom, which I enjoy doing that like a lot of people do with different professors.
Well, go ahead,
the case is going back to court. The germane part of the case is going back to court. It'll probably be Trump and some of the electors in either the aggrieved states or the subject states that'll be joining in, the Republicans, say, in Pennsylvania or whatever, Republican electors. And it's going to start at the district court level, and it's going to wind its way through to wherever. We'll see.
So Don, let me just jump in here because we have limited time. So basically, are you saying there's still a chance that this could be overthrown? And one other question, do you believe that the election was fraudulent?
From the beginning. I mean, well, first of all, just about every election in the United States is fraudulent in one fashion or another. The structure itself was designed almost, including the Electoral College, as a constraint on democratic rule as opposed to something to facilitate. The people that constructed this were property owners, including owning human property, and they wanted to protect their property rights above all else. And that is sort of in the DNA of the law here. So that I would say that about all of the presidential elections, but in this particular case, there's a unique constellation here of forces. And that is essentially the entrenched forces, the neocons and the neoliberals who have been in charge of policy in the United States and pretty much the world since 1991 anyway, but in the United States since the 1980s, and others who represent a look towards multipolarity in international relations as opposed to the hegemony. And secondly, again, on the question of war and peace with Russia and also with China, two divergent points of view that are apparently very strongly held. If you look at the effort and time and just the wordage put into the Russiagate narrative from before the election until about 3 weeks ago.
Jack, what now? Where do you see this going? We're looking at a very, very divided country. And regardless which individual becomes the next president, we're talking about individuals who've gotten the most votes ever of anyone ever running for president in the United States. So we're talking about many people, at least 75 million on each side here who voted, who are still very adamant about their candidate and very strong emotions about the other candidate. Your take on prognosis and can whoever's president bring the country together?
We have never seen our system stress tested in the way that we have during this election. And I will acknowledge over the last 4 years, it's been pretty brutal as well. But if we look at this election, we've never seen anything like this. There's going to be midterms coming up in 2 years. And what we find is that if the conservatives come out or whoever comes out and they decide they want a different person to be in the House, a different person to be in the Senate, then they should vote their choice. I think what's been incredibly disturbing, particularly about this election, is that this president has never had a problem with going after the Department of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Defense Department, the State Department, the intelligence community, or just about anybody else, and been willing to burn him to the ground in order to do so for his own benefit.
Okay, stay with me, Jack. I only have 30 seconds. Don, your take. Yeah, where do you see this going?
Very divided country. Also, really low confidence in the institutions. That's been, building for decades, but certainly in the last 8 years or so, that's been accelerating. So really a dangerous look ahead. And as far as it goes, if Trump saw the CIA, FBI, et cetera, as enemies, that relates with a lot of people in the United States. And not all maniac right-wingers either. I'm a lefty. I've been a communist my whole adult life. So I don't those are actually dangerous institutions. And to have an advocate in the White House for our position for a change is quite a remarkable thing, actually.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us for an interesting conversation. Don DeBar, journalist, radio host out of New York, and out of Minneapolis, Jack Rice, a lawyer and media analyst. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
If you're interested to know about history, culture,
family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Plenty of spectacular sights and things in the azure waters of the Persian Gulf. One of these must-see places is the historical Loft Port. The beauties of this port village are many. Today, I've made a trip to Qesh in order to visit the Loft Village and see its beauties from a closer view. Loft is one of the villages of Qesh in Hormozgan province, located in southern Iran. Loft Port is situated in northwest of Qesh Island. Residents of Loft made trips across the ocean by sailing boats and traded with African countries as well as India since not very long time ago. Loft is one of the very hot and humid regions of Iran. The most important professions of the residents of this village include lunch building, lunch maintenance, and fishing. In addition to natural beauties, this village has placed really precious heritages, including Naderi Castle, the Portuguese castle, Tala Wells, as well as a historical cemetery which has inscriptions dating back to 1,000 years ago. Standing by one of the beautiful mosques of Loft Village. This mosque is white in color, and its presence in the blue context of the sky looks very magnificent. Well, there are 7 mosques in Loft, and residential districts are made around these mosques. These mosques, besides being places of worship, are also places for cultural and social congregations of the villagers. Well, let's see what's going on in the residential areas. My God, what beautiful houses. The houses of this village have all central yards and wind catchers. The wind catchers are made in different sizes and have transformed the Loft village into the port of wind catchers. The architecture of these houses remind me of the city of Yazd. I am now beside the Tala Wells in Loft. I have never seen such a bizarre thing like this. The bottom part of these wells have plaster layers, which make it possible for the water to stay quite cool and healthy for a longer period of time. The surface waters of the village, which have been collected by the sudden rains, flow to the Tala Wells and the main cistern of the village. One of the local people told me that the number of these wells is 366, which represent the number of days in a leap year, and that people used one well for each day. To be honest, there are a lot of wells here, and I can't count them all. I am now by the shore. The beautiful launches of Loft residents are floating. Fishermen are busy catching fish. And the lovely sound of seagulls have doubled the beauty of Loft Village. I'm going to come back here in the evening so that I could have the opportunity to enjoy the beautiful moment of sunset. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.